Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the Affordable Care Act lives after the failure to pass the GOP health bill in the Senate. The president and members of Congress are still looking at a number of ways they might change the health law. This has thrown the insurance industry into a great deal of uncertainty. And when the insurance industry is calculating uncertain risk, rates go up for consumers.
Senate Health Committee leader Senator Lamar Alexander is considering other options that would actually strengthen the Affordable Care Act.
Senator Alexander will be holding bipartisan hearings in a few weeks to find measures that will stabilize the insurance markets and create fixes to the existing law.
The secretive nature of the recent health policy deliberations, I think, incurred a lot of wrath from many observers and left a lot of lawmakers kind of in the dark about what they actually would be voting on.
There are promising signs in the House as well, where the so-called Problem Solver Caucus has been working behind the scenes with about 40 House members from both sides of the aisle working to find solutions for some of the inherent problems with the ACA. But without bipartisan support, it's unlikely we'll see anything come to fruition.
While lawmakers figuratively duke it out inside the Beltway, innovators across the health landscape are developing new approaches to medical and scientific research. There are some great minds working in this space.
Which brings us to our guest today. Dr. Atul Butte is the Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg Distinguished Professor at UC San Francisco, where he leads the Institute for Computational Health Science. Really looking forward to that conversation.
And Lori Robertson will be stopping by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Atul Butte in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Health insurers have a looming deadline, August 18th, the day they must submit rates for the 2018 market year. There are still many unanswered questions impacting rate-setting decisions for the nation's insurers. Meanwhile, HHS Secretary Tom Price has been hinting that the individual mandate requiring folks to buy health insurance could be eliminated. Analysts warn that will mean more younger, healthier people will opt out of buying health insurance, meaning more older, sicker subscribers would make up the bulk of the insurance pool, again, something that would lead to much higher rates for all insurance consumers. U.S. News and World Report is out with its annual hospital rankings, and again, Rochester, Minnesota-based Mayo Clinic claims the number one spot. Rounding out the top five were Cleveland Clinic at number two, Johns Hopkins at number three, Mass General coming in at number four, and UC San Francisco Medical Center coming in at number five. University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center took first place in the cancer category, and Cleveland Clinic ranked top in cardiology and heart surgery. Best hospital for orthopedics is Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. And say bye-bye to the classroom lecture at the University of Vermont School of Medicine. This year's incoming class of first-year med students will be learning their introductory core material in an active rather than a passive classroom setting. UVM Medical School Dean William Jeffries cites a number of studies showing lectures aren't generally the best way to teach science and medicine. Students will have a variety of online tutorials and interactive group sessions to acquire their knowledge base. Dr. Jeffries believes this will become the norm at medical schools across the country in 10 to 20 years. And gene editing enters a bold new era. Researchers at Oregon Health and Science University, along with researchers at the Salk Institute, worked together on the project that took brand new embryos, just a single cell, and used CRISPR technology to edit out defective genes in a number of embryos with a certain kind of genetic heart disease marker. According to this study, the embryonic cells are very good at adapting to the spliced out gene. The NIH doesn't provide funding for using CRISPR in human embryo research, and the Food and Drug Administration is banned from considering studies that involve genetic altering of human eggs or embryos. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Atul Butte, the Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg Distinguished Professor at the University of California, San Francisco, where he leads the Institute for Computational Health Science, which is dedicated to the use of big data to advance precision medicine. A pediatrician and computer scientist, Dr. Butte is the Executive Director for Clinical Informatics, which integrates electronic health records from all six medical schools at the UC Medical School and Medical Center system. Dr. Butte earned his undergraduate degree in computer science and his medical degree at Brown University and earned his PhD from Harvard Medical School and MIT. He's an elected member of the National Academy of Medicine and was named an Open Science Champion of Change at the White House. Dr. Butte, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
What a great award that you received from Priscilla Chan and her husband, Mark Zuckerberg, who are using their assets to advance medical science. I wonder if you could just share with our listeners the most important problem you're trying to solve with your unique data-driven approach.
Yeah, this funding certainly helps launch this Institute for Computational Health Sciences here at UCSF. And the real important problem we're trying to deal with is how to improve the entire healthcare system. We are in a world where we have lots of data, and in fact, lots of open data. But now the new challenge is figuring out what to do with all this open data. What we're really trying to do is no less than trying to find new medicines, new insights into disease, and really learning, is what we're doing in medicine the very best medicine? Can we do it a better way? And I believe we have the answers to all of this in the data we're already measuring. And that's what we really get to showcase in this Institute for Computational Health Sciences.
As you say, Dr. Butte, we are in the midst of a data deluge in which the human species generates 2 zettabytes, I'm not quite sure how to say it, of data per year. So if we recycle the data we already have, we might be able to leapfrog over the scientific method that we all kind of grew up with.
So this estimate actually came from The Economist magazine that humans generate 2 zettabytes. We're probably up to 10 or 12. And what does that mean? We have a lot of data. Now, a lot of it are in the form of YouTube videos, right? But of course, what I'm focused on is biomedicine. And so in my world, where does all this data come from? So those researchers in the molecular world looking at genome sequences and all the functions of cells, they share a lot of data because the journals, the scientific journals they submit papers to, more or less require them to share that data. So that's a great thing. We have clinical researchers. If you go, for example, to clinicaltrials.gov right now, there are 250,000 studies registered there. Another important component of data in my world is from the clinical world. So, for example, imaging, if you look at just radiology, whether it's CAT scans or PET scans or even just chest x-rays, I think the current estimate is that there are 100 million chest x-rays run every year in the United States. And I think most of those are digitized today. Mm-hmm. A typical pathology practice might see 30,000 slides, but also all the dictated notes that's describing a case, and all the structured data elements, all the vital signs, the drugs, the doses. And then on top of that, we have personal data. Many of us are now being exposed to wearables, and our smartphones can help us really track behaviors of different kinds. You know, science itself is not going to get obsolete. But the scientific method, you know, what we're taught in third or fourth grade, is that you come up with a question first, and then you go make the measurements to answer that question. And this really echoes what Chris Anderson, who was the editor-in-chief of Wired, had a nice article in 2008 where he actually proposed that we can challenge that now, that we already have the measurements. 99% of the hard part now is figuring out what's the question we want to ask. What's the killer question we've been all dying to know the answer to? And no one's realized we could actually ask that question today.
Well, that's really fascinating. You say that one of your approaches is to conduct parallel computing of multiple data sets. And you also have helped develop the so-called gene activity data banks. I wonder if you could share with our listeners your approach.
So our Institute for Computational Health Sciences, now we have 40 faculty working on automated methods, for example, to find particular parts of radiology images like brain scans and mammography to find cancers or clots. We have faculty working on skin images to predict cancers or not. And that's an example. Both those are parallel computing in a way that they're not just looking at one image. They're looking at millions of images, but also collected dozens or hundreds of different ways, you know, different x-rays, different scans, different smartphones. So they're more robust in some way with their findings. We have faculty taking pieces like genes and molecules and learning the networks that link those pieces together. We have faculty in our institute working on smartphone apps, trying to get data from more patients to give them advice from that data. We also have faculty looking at epidemiology. And then, of course, there's my lab here. We've been looking at the gene activity data. And the idea here is to look at these cells and tissues to figure out which genes or which recipes are up or down and try to connect the effect of drugs to the effect of diseases. thinking about how a drug out there in a catalog, we can look at the catalog and realize that drug might reverse the effect of a disease that we also have measurements for. And really, what I mean by parallel experiments is that we don't have to just depend on one researcher's experimental data. We might have hundreds of researchers that might have studied this drug and hundreds that might have studied this disease. And now we can start to put those two together, really figure out what's in common across all of them.
Well, Dr. Bu, you've been focused on population health and precision medicine for some time now in California, and I understand you're also a principal investigator with the Precision Medicine Initiative at the National Institute of Health. Part of that initiative entails creating genomic data banks as well as biobanks. You've been working at this for some time now in California. How have you managed to catalog so much personal health data? Help us understand how this works and how scalable your work is to the national model.
So the Federal Precision Medicine Initiative, now known as the All of Us Research Cohort, is underway. I'm really lucky and privileged to be a principal investigator on the California component of that. So we're committed to recruiting tens of thousands of patients into the million or more that should be collected over the next 10 years. A lot of that data is going to be collected from participants as well as some blood tests, maybe even some genome sequences. Many of us are going to have access to that data to try to figure out what are the earliest signs of disease, and maybe there's some ways to prevent disease that we don't already know about. But in some ways, it's also going to be open to many people, even citizen scientists someday. Maybe even citizen scientists could come up with interesting findings from that data. Now, our California initiative is different. So a year before President Obama launched the Precision Medicine Initiative, our Governor Jerry Brown launched our own Precision Medicine Initiative here in California. And our approach here is to fund projects instead of a large cohort. And these range in terms of project teams that are composed of academics, as well as small companies, large companies, sequencing companies, and all the rest, trying to make a difference within 2 to 3 to 4 years for specific conditions like hypertension, like cancer, infectious diseases. So the idea was to fund projects and teams where a modest amount of resources could actually move those forward to directly help patients on a quicker time frame. And then here at the University of California, we have 6 University of California medical schools and medical systems. And obviously, each of those medical schools and medical systems has a set of patients that they treat and databases on their own campuses. And now what we're starting to think about is how we could build a single database to learn from each other in a much more efficient way and maybe to help improve the kind of care we're delivering in the University of California. So that's a huge number of patients. I think at one count, we reached something like 15 million patients. Now it's up to us to figure out, is that working and what can we do better? And in many cases, a lot of that's going to help a lot of people.
We're speaking today with Dr. Atul Butte, the Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg Distinguished Professor at the University of California, San Francisco, where he leads the Institute for Computational Health. You know, wonderful to see that Dr. Collins has really redefined this approach to the newly entitled All of Us Initiative, really trying to engage citizen scientists across racial, ethnic, economic boundaries. You talked earlier about the whole role of citizen scientist getting engaged. And I wonder if you could just pull the thread on that. Where do you see the opportunities for people of any age who want to be engaged in these types of initiatives?
I tend to take in high school students over the summer, like a lot of scientists do, and you get, you know, firsthand experience on what smart high school kids and citizen scientists can do. You know, in the biomedical space, I think citizen scientists really want to learn more about themselves. We see citizen scientists adopting crowdsourced types of methodologies like microbiome measurements and contributing pictures and samples to various different initiatives. In the All of Us research cohort, I think this is one of the most ultimate ways that citizen scientists could get involved, to really learn about yourself and to realize that biomedical research needs more willing partners to help us learn. We want to reach a more diverse set of people, especially in this Precision Medicine Initiative, to help us learn how to keep you healthy and to recover from illness sooner. I think, you know, those are the ultimate goals here. Now, what I really want to get to is a, you know, someday a more educated population where citizen scientists also want to use that data to help science and help their own communities. Someday, an activist group might download data and start to realize that their fellow citizens in a particular area might be more susceptible to disease. Mm-hmm. And maybe that all launches because some citizen scientists realize that they and their community could be better. I think that's the most empowering part of data here.
You know, I think of you at one of the nation's leading teaching institutions at UCSF. It's a whole new day in terms of training and preparing our clinicians for the future with their access to the kind of data we're talking about and the kind of very sophisticated analytics. When you look around, how are we changing the training and education model for the next education of healthcare providers, making sure that they have access to this most sophisticated data and science that they can have? How are we doing with that shift?
Obviously, we're in a data-rich world, and analytics is key. And health training and health professional training has always been changing. But at the same time, it's a fixed type of time frame where not much can really be added to a four-year curriculum. I do see education and training changing more towards teaching the doctor of the future how to interpret the medical literature better, more education on communicating with patients, because that's going to be a critical component of the medical job of the future. And more understanding of maybe how technology fits in from the order entry side and those systems we have in hospitals to how clinical research actually works and wearables and how to interpret that type of data. It goes without saying, I think the health professional of the future is in for lifelong learning. I mean, the learning isn't going to stop at medical school or residency or fellowship. That lifelong learning is going to be coming in bits and pieces throughout one's career, but we need to teach doctors at the very least that we have better digital tools out there than just Google queries. And we have to build those tools and we build more of them and then teach them to the medical professionals of the future.
You know, I want to just explore that a little about the digital tools and your earlier statement about the power of data. And, you know, we've had a great opportunity on our show to talk with people like Eric Topol, Anish Chopra, Todd Park, all sort of committed to liberating data. We've also had here in Connecticut at Yale, Harlan Krumholtz, who's also working in this particular area. Patients don't own their data. I mean, it seems to me right now we have to develop apps that really empower patients to do it. So when are we going to really get those citizen scientists excited because we developed apps that provide people with their own data and they can share with researchers as they deem appropriate? It seems like we've disconnected people, those citizen scientists, from really being jazzed and excited about this new world that's opening up.
So patients can get access to their own data. Any hospital, any medical system, if you go to medical records, you'll learn very quickly that you can get to data that way. Many of the electronic health record systems do have apps where you can at least see medical records. Some medical systems have what are called open notes, so you can actually look at the actual notes that the doctors are writing. Not everyone has that, I admit. What you're talking about and what you're kind of proposing is the next step where we should approach patients and ask them to participate in every single study in the future. And I think that is an amazingly ideal world, and I would love it if we could get there. But we're in this world where we're constantly teaching people now not to click on dangerous links on emails. What would you say if, for example, your own parents got an email prompting them to click on something and that link actually asked them all sorts of detailed health questions? Wouldn't you be skeptical? Wouldn't you be worried? Right? So how are we going to teach the participants of the future how to even participate via email or links, given in this world of fraud and spam? I wish we could get there, but I'm getting increasingly skeptical now that we're going to be able to directly reach participants of studies this way. We're teaching them the opposite, not to click on dangerous links and enter in specific health and important details about oneself. So I do believe patients can get their own data. I agree. The apps to interpret that data aren't there. Easy ways to try to figure out what's going on with that data aren't there. And I'm not sure how we're going to reach that state anymore, given how much mistrust we put into emails now.
We've been speaking with Dr. Atul Butte, the Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg Distinguished Professor at the University of California at San Francisco, where he leads the Institute for Computational Health Sciences. You can learn more about his work by going to buttelab.ucsf.edu or follow him on Twitter. That's at Atul Butte, A-T-U-L-B-U-T-T-E. Dr. Butte, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to continuing these kinds of discussions.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump said on Twitter that, quote, bailouts for members of Congress will end very soon, end quote, if Congress doesn't pass a new health care bill. The president misuses the word bailout to describe the federal government's contribution towards health insurance premiums for members of Congress. A bailout is financial assistance to save a failing company or industry. Under the Affordable Care Act, Congress must get health insurance coverage through the ACA marketplaces. That provision of the ACA added to the legislation after some Republicans pushed the idea that if the exchanges were good enough for other Americans, they should be good enough for Congress, has prompted several variations of false claims about Congress somehow being exempt from the law. Before the ACA, Congress got insurance coverage through the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. The Federal Employees Health Benefits Program offers government employees a choice of health plans, with the federal government, as the employer, paying a portion of the premiums. But the exchanges or marketplaces were set up for those buying their own insurance and small businesses, not large employers like the federal government. In 2013, the Office of Personnel Management, which administers the Federal Health Benefits Program, issued a rule clarifying that while Congress couldn't get any premium tax credits available through the exchanges, members and their staffs would continue to get the employer contribution toward premiums. OPM said, quote, the amount of the employer contribution toward their exchange premiums is no more than would otherwise be made toward coverage under the FEHB program. That's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Vaccinations are considered one of the great public health achievements of the 20th century, reducing fatalities from most common and fatal diseases by up to 99%. But in the 21st century, some of those numbers just aren't stacking up. As recently as 2009, only 45% of the nation's preschool-age children had received all of their recommended vaccinations, and researchers at the Children's Outcome Research Program at Children's Hospital in Colorado decided to take an in-depth look at the problem. Dr. Allison Kemp heads up the Children's Outcome Research Program, and she conducted a study on what would help to generate better compliance with the required vaccinations. And she found that when parents received timely reminders from their state and local health departments, parents were much more likely to get the vaccinations and boosters for their children that they needed.
What our study did was to centralize those efforts. So it didn't take away from the primary care providers, but it helped them to do the reminder recall for their practices centrally using a state registry.
Dr. Kemp says her research shows that when a reminder message can be generated for an entire population, it takes the onus and the burden off of the primary care and pediatric practices.
In a fairly short period in the counties where this was done centrally, about 19% of children who were not up to date became up to date, versus about 13% in the practice-based recall state, which on a population level is really very powerful.
And the study also suggests that there's a cost savings with a centralized state or county-run database and reminder system and reduced medical costs as fewer children fall ill.
You know, you have one case of Haemophilus meningitis can cost tens of thousands of dollars.
A state health department-driven vaccination program that assists private practices in vaccine compliance for their patient population, improving vaccination rates of young and vulnerable children. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.